My name is Dan Erlander, and the title for our forum tonight is Spiritual Journeys. And I'd like to begin to kind of share how this idea came to be, and then open it up. One thing, I feel strange here. I just figured out I don't think I've led a forum at home for like 2 years. A number of thoughts came together. Every once in a while, somebody here at Holden says, all you do at Holden is to talk about social issues. Why don't we just have the time to share our faith? That's a good idea. So here we are. We are lonely often in the church because somehow in our society it has been communicated that religion is supposed to be, or religious experience is to be so personal, that we really fail to share our spiritual journeys with each other, and that's a way we fail to really get to know each other. It's a way that the body of Christ, the community of Christ, really fails, I think, to become one. We need, I think, to share both the joys of the journey of faith and also its hard points. I remember a congregation in Albuquerque once. We had a group of people that were in a Bible study, and an inactive member, you know, an inactive member is somebody that doesn't go to church very often. The final definition. Came to this Bible study when the kind of pillars of the church were sharing their doubts about the faith. And this person was just awestruck that my goodness, these people that she thought had no doubts ever were sharing it. And there's a sense of community there that was found. So with that background, what I'd like to just share something from my life. Elmer was going to lead this tonight, and Elmer has a bad cold. So I'm going to share something from mine, and then Norm and I both went over to find out if Elmer was coming. So we sat there and planned this, and Norm's going to share something, and then just like to invite anyone to share anything from your personal experience that might be helpful or uplifting to the rest of us. Okay, I'll begin, and this takes a certain amount of risk. I grew up in a church that was kind of a Baptist Lutheran church, and we had testimony sharing. And I remember people getting up, and the best thing you could do is share how awful you were before you were saved. You know, if you had been a drug addict, then you were, that was really great. And so from that point of view, my testimony is very boring. So I'll start with that and probably put you to sleep. Because something happened to me that was maybe the most vivid experience of faith, and I called it the day I was saved from goodness. Are you ready for this? Saved from goodness. I grew up in a very, very pious, you would say, religious Lutheran home. And I don't think my parents really taught me this consciously, but we kept a lot of the good rules of the faith, like no card playing and things like that. And I very soon put this opinion inside of myself that somehow I was better than other people. That being a Christian was really being separated from that. And I remember I still carried this with me when I went to college. PLU, I fit right into the religious group. And one of my biggest blows at PLU was when I lost the election for prayer meeting leader. But I remember, kind of surrounding myself with religious and priests and people, and most of the students I was really separated from. and still had a sense that somehow in God's eyes I was one step above them spiritually. And then I went to seminary. I mean, where else do morally superior people go than to seminary? And then everybody that goes to seminary goes to clinical training. You go to a hospital and you're a chaplain for a summer. Had a strange thing that happened in clinical training. You're with a group of other students, and back in those days you kind of do this thing of getting personal. And one day one of the other students just told me, you know, you're so nice, and the reason you're so nice, it's a beautiful way to manipulate everybody. And my response was, no. I mean, I'm nice because I'm a Christian. And then I had this shock of every other person in the group affirming what this person had said, and we went on for an hour of my denying this, and finally it was a hopeless cause. There was just too much evidence piling up. And then the chaplain instructor, who usually sat outside of the group and kind of observed, leaned forward and he said, "It's true." You manipulate me too by being so nice and good. And I remember as a very emotional of finally just saying yes to that, you know, and there were tears of saying yes to that. And the grace event of this was these students, instead of saying, "Well, we won that one," they all put their arms around me and just for a long time hugged me. And I came out of that hug. No, this was long before Holden. I came out of that hug seeing the whole world, every human being on earth, as common with me. And I suppose in language we all have grown up with, I finally saw myself on my knees as sinners with the rest of the human race. And I give thanks to God for that experience, because I do a lot of work now with the peace issue. I go out and speak on the war peace issue. Get a lot of flack. My mother says I'm involved in a controversial issue. She told me that. But to look back on that experience and really have been helped by that, to never look at anybody, even what we call a warmonger, and in any way think that I'm morally superior, but to have been graced that way. I slip. I even manipulate people still by being nice. But the gracefulness of being, I think, a beggar, you know, as Luther said, along with everybody else. In my spiritual journey, I would give thanks to those five students who had the courage to not let go of me. And so that's experience in my life. No.
I'm glad you're not nice. I'm awfully glad you're not nice anymore.
Now we're going to hear from a miserable sinner.
Why do you go to typecasting? I'd like to focus on something that I've been thinking about and working at for a few years now, and I've never talked about before. So I'm not sure I can verbalize this quite as eloquently as I wish I might. To give you the background to this particular facet of what I'm talking about, you should know that of the 35 years of ordained service I've put in, 22 of it was spent wearing the uniform of the United States Air Force and serving as a chaplain. Starting just a few years after ordination and winding up about 11 years ago. And this came out of what I think was probably a reasonably decent motive, having been sheltered in seminary during the years of World War II, came the time of the Korean conflict, and the church urgently put out the word, we need pastors to serve our people in the armed forces as chaplains. And I responded. And what set out to be a minimum tour of duty of perhaps 3 years wound up to be a career of 22. Looking back on it and trying to figure out how I configured my ministry in that setting, it's beginning to fall into place. This was in a time, mind you, at the beginning of the Korean War, when almost no part of the Lutheran Church or its people were not very solidly behind the national purpose. It was not like the latter days of the Vietnam conflict and the things that have come in its wake, and I think that's important to recognize. At any rate, I fell into a rather easy pattern in that ministry of thinking of it principally as being a pastoral thing. I can see, as has been said many times over, that ministry falls principally into two categories. There is the pastoral and the prophetic. Most ministries that I've known, pastoral ministries in parishes, have been far, far more pastoral than they have been prophetic. I think it's been the rule more than the exception. And therefore, it became a very easy kind of a pattern to follow when serving communities of people serving their country in military service, to serve what seemed to be their appropriate needs for their pastoral upkeep, the serving them at various kinds of life functions at the point of marriage and baptisms and occasionally deaths and sickness, as well as the whole range of workaday kinds of needs, the education of children and the problems of marriage and excesses, abuse of substances, the whole range of things. But to hasten through 22 years, toward the latter end of things, and I have to say that that judged by military standards, it was a successful 22 years in which I managed to wind up with the grade of colonel, which gave me a not uncomfortable retired pay for the rest of my life, for which I thank all good taxpayers and even bad taxpayers. The 11 years I've endured that have followed, ensued is the word, since that time, have led me into some other kinds of visions. I found it very easy to justify, and I can still, to a large extent, justify the churches giving a ministry to people who are in the armed services, because the church's job is ministry to its people wherever they are. And there are sizable numbers of the people of the church who are serving in the armed services. I'm still involved to a certain extent in that regard, doing some management of that on behalf of my own branch of the Lutheran Church. But since that time, I've seen the other side of a good many of the points of contention. I've become involved in the last 11 years with people who have been members, long-standing members, of the historic peace churches, where I once found it very easy to buy into a lot of the military stance of our country on the basis of the Augustinian just war theory. I have in more recent years come to question that, not as a workable principle historically, but as one that is no longer useful in an atomic era, in a nuclear age. It seems to me that as we look at those principles, that there's no way that they can still be applied with the same kind of validity that they could when people were throwing rocks at each other or even trading bullets or bombs. When the capacity to eradicate society as we know it and the world as God gave it to us is in our hands and can be unleashed at any given point. The concept, therefore, of deterrence is one that I find no longer useful to me, which puts me at odds with a lot of people with whom I formerly served and creates for me even now some tensions that I'm trying to work through. I see this not simply as a political move in my journey, but as I think a genuine kind of a spiritual trip that's taking me down a road that I cannot yet see the end of, or light at the end of which. But I've become deeply grateful for the light that's been shed on that path by some people who have become very special to me, including a few who have become special to me during the 6 weeks that I've spent here at Holden. But one whom I would like to see eventually brought here to Holden is one that I think has been a great mentor to me, a Presbyterian by the name of Kermit Johnson. He's a good friend of mine. Kermit was the chief of chaplains of the U.S. Army. He left it with the rank of a major general, retired early because he had some conflicts in his own mind, and is now speaking out with the kind of a vigor that very few of us have been able to put together. He's one of the sanest people I know when it comes to combining the Christian ethic with political and national direction. I'm not sure that I can say a great deal more than that because I'm not sure that I'm kind of in the middle of taking the next step. Until the foot comes down, I have to leave a question mark. Oh.
Somebody else share. It can be completely different than what we've shared. But
I've been a religious maverick, I guess. I was raised a Baptist.
Just a minute, before you begin, I don't know how to say this. Two fears I had was that nobody would say anything or somebody would give a 30-minute. So I hope you'll all share, but remember to keep yours brief enough so others get a chance.
I was kind of raised a Baptist, nominal, very nominal, and turned Lutheran when I got married, strictly because my wife was Lutheran. And I guess first became acquainted with Christ at a Dale Carnegie leadership course. And because the guy that was the instructor there was probably preaching Christ as much as he was Dale Carnegie. And that was back in 1957, and that kind of started my religious journey or my faith journey. And then in 1971, we came to Holden Village for 2 weeks. I came up here to work on one of the vehicles, I think, which is right down at the bottom of the hill right now, not being used. But I can remember one evening sitting here in Koinonia talking about money in the church. And usually back in those days, I used to get pretty upset about whenever anybody started talking about finances in the church, and because I felt we spent too much time talking about that. I mentioned something, I don't even know what I said, but that was back in the days when these type things were lasting until sometimes 11, 12 o'clock at night. I can remember walking out this door here, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw somebody else walk out at the same time. And as we got on the porch, he said, "Marsh, I like what you said in there." And I don't even remember what I said, really, but I remember we stood there and talked, shared our faith for about a half hour, 45 minutes. And we wound up out in the middle of the street in the rain. And before we left, it turned out he, I don't even remember his name or anything about him except that he was a seminary student. And he said, there's a little book I think you ought to learn, I ought to read. And I said, what's that? He said, A Taste of New Wine by Keith Miller. He said, they probably have it in the library. Well, they did have it in the library here, but still do. But I didn't have time to read it then, so when I got home, I bought the book and read it. Liked it so well that I wrote Keith Miller a letter, never expecting to get an answer. 2 weeks later, I got a handwritten letter suggesting I get into small groups, which I eventually did, which is basically talking about sharing honestly. Two of the guys that were in that small group were members of this organization, of the Switzerland Guide Summit Expedition, which I eventually got actively involved with. So Christian Outward Bound is basically what it is. But because of that, it was a kind of a series of steps that happened to me and our entire family that probably led us back here this summer, last summer, and then the commitment this year. It also led us also to try to get away from the city life because I felt that after spending 3 weeks in the mountains and coming back to San Diego where we lived at that time, that the concrete jungle was making me a kind of a robot driving back and forth every day on the freeway. So it in a way gave me the courage, or gave me and Lois the courage just to uproot. We had moved several other times, but this is the first time that we had the opportunity to just buy a piece of bare land without knowing what we were going to do with it, except live on it some way. Certainly the Lord led us there where we are and gave us water and everything that we need. But one of the things, I guess, while we were there, paradise, and one of the things I had to do was dig a trench for our water line, about a 500 or 600 foot ditch. And where we live is kind of like here. It got a lot of lava cap. It's an old, ancient volcanic area. We're just south of Mount Lassen, which is the last mountain in the chain of mountains in the Cascades. So therefore, when you dig anything in the ground, you have to go around gigantic boulders. Well, I always like to go, straight through, and I like to have everything exactly perfect. The ditch was supposed to, according to the county, it was supposed to be 18 inches deep. Well, it was impossible to do that because some of the boulders were so large that I couldn't do it. And so consequently, I had to go around them, sometimes not quite as deep as I would like to. And I can remember starting that darn ditch and looking at it and saying, this is impossible. This is an impossible task. But I was doing it by hand. I could have gotten a ditcher, but I would have wound up ruining it because of all the rocks, I felt, anyhow. So with a pick and a shovel, I started doing that thing. And as I started out, something said, well, just take one step at a time, 1 inch at a time. So I did 1 inch at a time. And as I did 1 inch at a time, I found that I could, work my way around these rocks. Finally, after 2 weeks of sweat and toil and so forth, working in the dirt, I finally got to the end of it. And two things that I really learned about that one digging of that ditch was that, first of all, in life, we have to take one step at a time, one day at a time, and not always look at the goal out there, but just to go enjoy the what you're doing right now and forget about out there. And secondly, that sometimes you can't just go a straight line. You have to go around the obstacles. But that's my story. That was, to me, a very profound thing, just being able to do that and learn from a very simple idea of digging a ditch.
Film The Year of Living Dangerously. It's about the overthrow of the government in Indonesia in the 60s. And Billy Kwan is a photographer who has contacts in all levels of the Indonesian society, a very loving character. I should mention that Billy Kwan is also a dwarf. and knows the high government officials and knows the very poor of the country. And one of the questions that's asked to Billy in the movie is, how is it that you love, or how is it that you live the life that you do? And he says, well, I guess you just give with love to whoever it is that God puts in your path. And that sounds like a very simple thing to do. And I guess I would like to say that I accept that as my philosophy of life. But then I'm not so sure how I've done as that's happened. And there's another story that's happened to me that seems like an amazing one to me. The summer before I was to start seminary, I was traveling from Rochester, Minnesota, where I was working, to the small town nearby where I was living. And I picked up a hitchhiker who seemed like quite a character. He was carrying this very overstuffed suitcase and a teddy bear. And as I picked him up when we got talking, he told me that he was traveling all of the highways in the country in numerical order, starting with 1 and then 2 and then 3. And that he was checking out the card catalogs in order to see if they were up to date. And then he would winter in Washington, D.C., at the Library of Congress to do his research. And the guy seemed kind of crazy to me. And it was a really good story, and I enjoyed the trip, but he didn't really smell very well. And I was glad at the point that that I let him off to let him off. I gave him a couple of dollars and was kind of smug about that and just kind of let him on his way. He didn't really have any place to stay that night, but I guess I thought he could hitchhike through the night. I was on Highway 14 at the time, so he had just finished 13, and 15 would be his next one. The following fall, I was in Gettysburg, and it was a Sunday night, and we didn't eat on campus. It was my first year of seminary, and in the refectory where we ate was closed that on Sunday, so a group of classmates and I were out at some fast food restaurant and eating, and I looked out the window, and this huge realization came to me that we were on Highway 15, and he was walking up the door to this, I think it was a McDonald's. And so I quick told my friends the story before the guy got there so they would believe me, and they went out and greeted him. And I was really excited to see this guy twice in about 3 months' time in two completely different parts of the country. What a coincidence. And we talked to him for a while, and of course he didn't remember me. He's encountered so many hitchhikers. And I was really disappointed about that. And then he asked for some money. And right away my friend said, well, this guy just wants your money. Let's get out of here. And we left. And the next spring, it was time to prepare for the final sermon for my preaching class. And I was supposed to be preaching on the lepers. It was the story of the great leper. And at the same time, I was interviewing for Lutheran Volunteer Corps. I had decided that I was going to leave seminary for a while and serve in that way in Washington, D.C. So I was down there for an interview at a place called Shoals Cafeteria. And Shoals is down in inner city Washington. And I was with the two people who were interviewing for me. And Shoals is a place where they have very good food at very low prices. And a lot of people from the businesses nearby and government offices nearby go there to eat, but a lot of street people who've gotten donations from people also go there to eat. And so it's a very neat place with very nutritional meals. And as we were in line, I noticed the person in front of me was dressed kind of funny, wearing these coveralls, and it was a hot May day. Coveralls made of corduroy and a winter cap where the flaps come over his ears and things. And I wasn't paying a lot, I sort of saw out of the corner of my eyes, but I was talking to the two people who were interviewing me. And then I did finally look up, and again it was this man who I had seen twice previously that year in different parts of the country. And so we got talking, and it was Shakespeare's birthday that day, and he invited me to a Shakespeare festival. And he talked very loudly, and you could tell that maybe there was some mental imbalance or something. And I was getting looks from people sort of like, oh, it takes all kinds, or boy, you sure got trapped in a conversation with this guy, and things. And it was really easy to see him as the leper, as the untouchable one. I mean, it was all coming together for me for the sermon, I thought. But then as I thought more about it, I thought, well, who's really the leper? Who's really the untouchable one? Is it him? Or is it all of us, you know, me who doesn't know how to love him, who is untouchable in my loving? You know, who failed to be touched enough by this person to even know exactly how to respond in love to this person. And I don't know if I've still figured out, you know, what that path is. What's the best Christian loving response? It's not, Billy Kwan's message is not a simple one. It's one that leads to suffering, and for Billy Kwan it led to his death, and so it led to Christ's death too. And I think as Christian servants it leads to all of our deaths. One final thing. I did move to Washington and see him a number of times. After that, I used to go running right around the White House, and he spent a lot of time there, as well as sleeping outside on a heating grate. And the church I worked for made soup runs regularly, and I would occasionally see him on the heating grate. He's still alive, and I won't say well, but surviving the highways in the nation's capital.
I'm not used to speaking in front of people, so we'll see how this goes. I guess for a long time in my life, I had a real question about what's the balance of faith and works sort of things. And I was raised in a Baptist church, and I didn't really realize it at the time. Now that I look back on it, I think I saw everything as something I do. Choose to be baptized and be good and try to be every person. And finally, by the time I went to graduate school, I guess I had a concept of trying to be perfect. And actually, kind of two things were going on when I was in graduate school. I was trying to be perfect on the one hand, and on the other hand, I decided to reject everything that I had grown up with, and trying to start from scratch and say, is there a God? Which, that question only lasted about 2 days, because it was really hard to study if there was a God. I decided there was one.
That's it, I studied.
But, I don't know, well, it was like a lot of different trains of things were going on. I was running into people that were asking questions about spiritual things that I never thought of, so I started asking them too. And reading about a lot of religions and that sort of thing. And finally, I started reading a lot of C.S. Lewis. And I had a lot of intellectual questions that I think I just kept coming up with more and more, would go ask the campus minister one of these questions, hoping that it would stump him, because then it would keep me from having to commit myself to Christianity or anything like that. And in the meantime, I was trying to be a perfect clarinetist and a perfect person and a perfect teaching assistant and nothing. Well, I don't know if it's funny, but it's like the worst thing that happened in my life turned out to be really, really good, because it's like my own allegory of grace and that sort of thing. And when my last year of graduate school, I decided that I was drinking too much, so I decided to stop, and I couldn't. And so for a couple of months, I wrestled with this, and finally, came to the conclusion that I was an alcoholic, and that wasn't real fun to think about. And it was a long, long struggle. It took about a year before I could stop drinking completely. But now that I look at it, it's like it put me in such a helpless position. And it was something, I couldn't even try to pretend. Like, sometimes I felt like before, I didn't have a very good self-concept, and I was this little worm or something. But I was proud of being a worm, and I wanted to be a self-sufficient little worm. And, you know, it really, well, like in AA, the first step says we admitted we're powerless over alcohol. Our lives had become unmanageable. And that we admitted we were powerless, to me, has become like a real strong spiritual concept just of my whole life, that that I was at a point where I was absolutely helpless, and I didn't even want to believe in God at that point. It's funny because it brought me so low, and yet now I have I'm more sure of my self-worth now that I've had everything stripped away, every pretense that I could of my own construction of my self-worth, and and then after a long stretch, I sort of just, in some ways, I feel like I was just getting back on my feet when I moved to Tacoma. I'm from Tacoma now. And then I got dumped in the Holden Village somehow, and you know, it's just God's perfect timing of all of a sudden relief. And I think a lot about a scripture I read when I did Matins right before I left before, from Lamentations 3, because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. His compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness.
Thank you.
We can go until 10, so there's...
We should stop a few minutes
before. 5 to 10.
Another session follows immediately.
So I have two hands here.
That's all right.
You want to go first and then...
I probably have to introduce myself once again. I'm Kutumbeni Kating from Namibia. And I learned reconciliation probably the hard way because of the racial tension in my country. At the age of 18 in high school, we happened to have a quiz on the chapter of how the Europeans took over the country, and at the bloodiest massacre where the Germans were killing the Africans. And so we went on strike that we were not going to take the quiz on this chapter because it was an insult to. But being in a private Lutheran high school with this Swedish teacher, it's a kind of had a different tone to it because. To the teacher, it was, doing her job, teaching us history, using the prescribed book by the government, but trying to teach us the more in-depth of the whole history. But to the teenagers, it was more of, we perceived her as a part of the oppressive white force. So, she threatened us that if we don't turn in the test, she's going to report to the principal, which was a part of the discipline. So we kind of turn in the blank sheets of tests and of a quiz. Upon handing in my paper, I said, well, you take this, Oshilumu, which means white person, you know. And everybody, of course, was kind of very hurt by the content of the whole chapter. So, and she really took that seriously, and I didn't know for like a week she could not teach because of that statement. She had a hard time to enter the country, and that was supposed to be her last stay in Namibia, and when the visa expired she wouldn't come back. So she felt she was doing her best for the poor African students who didn't have qualified teachers, and things were like falling apart. So, and then she decided to call me to her office, and I went there and I said, well, I couldn't even remember saying take this, white man, white person. So, and she said, well, it hurt me, and you know, I didn't go to school the whole week, you know, because I didn't have peace of mind. And so we had about 2 hours discussion about, so because she was trying to approach me from the Christian upbringing which I had from my family, because my parents are good Christians, and so she was asking me whether I have undergone any reconciliation. I said yes. Then she asked me to give her some examples where I was reconciled with my brother or my sister or my parents. And of all the events prior to that, they were merely eating a candy or, you know, a small, very small thing. You know, it was not a real serious situation. And in most cases, I was really responsible for, I knew I was conscious of hurting a brother or a parent. But in this case, even though I was not conscious of my statement, she was still hurt. So I came to learn that even though one is not conscious of what he's saying, that can still bring a very big separation. And it is through understanding that the two people or more, or two sides can come together by sharing the, you know, what is hurting others, not necessarily being conscious of what you said. So, and that was a very good, and from then on I was always very careful with you know, what I was saying, and accepting also the fact that I can hurt some other people with something which I didn't mean to hurt them, or, you know, or I meant to tell somebody else. So that was a very, very good. And since then we have been very good friends.
It's reconciliation.
Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to learn that way, especially being a teenager.
Go ahead. I'm Ray Martin, and I've had a strange experience that you might be interested in. I was born in 1925. When I was 3 years old, in 1928, I hung myself. We had a tire swing in our yard in Mount Carroll, Illinois, and as you used the tire swing, it sunk lower and lower, the rope stretched, and in order to shorten it so it wouldn't drag on the ground, they had just looped the rope. I was the youngest of four children, and while the other children were playing off, I climbed up in the tire swing and got my neck in it and hung myself. And they didn't notice me for quite a while. When they finally noticed me and took me down, my father, who was at that time a backsliding Lutheran, third degree Mason, and an alcoholic, and contemplating actually divorcing my mother, which he did finally, that becomes significant, I think, after a while, rolled me over a barrel. That was evidently back in 1928, one method of artificial respiration, which some people have told me is true, though I had never heard of that. And they got the doctor from North Carolina to come out, but in those days, 1928, you know, things didn't happen all that quick. And the doctor said I was dead, and he could do nothing about it. And my father insisted they take me to Freeport, Illinois, which is about 50 miles from Mount Carroll, Illinois, forced the doctor to get in the car with him, and they drove to Freeport, to the hospital, got to the hospital, and they didn't want to admit me because they said I was dead. Well, I'm not. I had a tracheotomy. I still have the scar here. And so on. Well, that's only part of the story. I graduated from high school. About that time, decided I would go into the ministry. Completed the ministry training at Wartburg Seminary. Went to graduate school and had gotten married. And Alice and I had written to the board and said we'd go to New Guinea as missionaries. And they said, we want you to go to India. And of course, I wrote home to my parents and said, we're going to go to India after our training. And anyway, they came to visit us. It was still about 4 years off. And then my father said, I'm going to tell you something I've never told anyone. And I checked out later. He had not told this to anybody in the family, so nobody knew this. He said, while I was rolling you over the barrel, remember he was a backsliding, third-degree Mason, alcoholic, and did divorce my wife. I don't know how many sins or how godless that may have seemed, you know, at that time to a Lutheran community. He said, I prayed. And I said to God, if you let him live, I'll give him to the ministry. My father couldn't give me to the ministry. He never talked to me about that. I think that's just an amazing answer to prayer of a person you could say had no right to pray to God for it. And that has been a great comfort to me as I think of prayer and the power of prayer when we don't even realize it.
We're glad you're here. We're glad you're here.
That's one of the reasons I'm here, probably.
Thanks.
I'd like to share one thing that happened to me last summer. I've had a lot of things happen over and over that constantly remind me that God is the one who's in control. And I'm just kind of along for the ride or something, I don't know, but it was real. Last summer I worked at a residential treatment center and for emotionally disturbed kids, and I was pretty distraught with all of the things that were I was confronted with every day that I went to work and was, you know, seeing all this stuff. But anyway, I played on a softball team, and on that softball team were a couple of other Christian women, and they had asked Jan and I to go to this concert down in Des Moines to Dallas Home and Praise, and they're a musical group. And I thought it was someone like Billy Graham or something like that, and I thought, oh, I don't want to go to this because I know if I go, I'll have to stand up when they tell you, you know, that when they say if you're a sinner to stand up and confess your, or, you know, if you're having troubles, you need to stand up, because I was having a lot of trouble with my life at that point. And I thought, I don't want to go and I don't want to stand up. So I hemmed and hawed and wasn't going to go and tried to make up all these excuses. And then I found out it was a singing group, and I thought, oh, how horrible. Okay, well, I'll go to that then. So we got down to Des Moines, and they sang all their songs and all that. And then at the end, he, I don't know what's his name, Dallas, or anyway, Dallas Holmes came out and talked to everybody. And here it came. Then he started to say something about how people who were having trouble or had financial worries or worried with their job and that, you know, if they would want to turn this over to the Lord or confess it to them or, you know, get it off their minds or just to recognize it, to stand up. And I thought, oh, here it goes. This is the reason I wasn't coming. So I stood up. I knew that I needed to face that. So I stood up. And so then person Jan, she stood up, and then I start laughing because I'm going, here it is. I didn't want to do this, and you know, I could just see God in heaven just laughing at me, just going, right, play the trick on you. Then I thought, well, this is okay, this is pretty unrisky. I just had to stand up. Then he wanted us to come down front. So here we go. Just dying the whole way, going, this is not what I'm doing. So I walk down front, and then we go off into another room. Then after the concert was over, and he talked to us. But I think I just really remember that, and I think of that in a lot of my experiences of how constantly I am reminded that, you know, these things, just because you didn't want to go, because you didn't want to stand up, that, I don't know, he's always in control, and we can rest in that, even though it doesn't seem like it, or we don't want to do something, he's usually there somewhere.
Thank you. I think we have time to stop.
I think it is. We do need to reconfigure the room a little bit, but yes, indeed. Thank you for your sharing.
Yeah, I'd like to, just before we close, is to share a prayer to pull together all of the faith journeys that have been shared, and by those who are being shared, we just know every person sitting here in this room has a story. And a hope I would have for tonight, this would be a beginning of not only your whole life, but our days here at Holden. Share stories with each other. For many of us, it's easier one-to-one. I never speak in groups like this. I did it tonight because I was the leader. I'm always the one that's scared. So I know everyone here has the story you'd like to hear, and it's just part of our being here together at Holden. So let's pray. God, we come to you to give thanks for the way that you have moved in our lives and touched our lives, the different journeys, for your presence. We give our thanks. Amen.